Saunders, reel number 2. Now, after you'd successfully passed your trade test and became a bona fide member of the Royal Flying Corps, what do you remember of these few weeks at Farnborough when you were involved in your basic training?
Well, one was being disturbed at 6 o'clock in the morning and out on parade at 6:30, properly shaved. We were on parade at about 7:30. Then we knocked off for breakfast. And after that, then we're back on the square again. And these NCO guards, NCOs from the guards, they knew all the drill. And they, being time service men, of course, they didn't like us, because we used to tell them that we'd kept them in luxury for years, and then when a job had to be done, we had to come and do it ourselves. And of course, they didn't appreciate this and took it out of us. Excuse me. And their main object in life was to break our bloody hearts, as they said. Well, after breakfast then, we had some more drill, and then we had a bit of a break. We could get a cup of Coke or something like that. And then we went off on a route march and came back in time for dinner at 1 o'clock. Well, this was a general scramble. And then at 2:30, we were drilling again till about 3:30. Another 20 minutes break. And by that time, after we'd done all these drills, none of us knew how to put on a putty. The result was these putties were round and round our legs, and they'd all moved into different shapes, and up some up her legs, some down her legs. This annoyed the NCOs more than ever. So we had to spend some time getting them on. And then in order to try and make them look decent, we used to pull them a bit tight on the legs. Well, this was fatal, because after walking about 20 minutes, your shin bone ached like the devil. And you still had to carry on, and you just tore them off when you got back for tea. And we knocked off then about 4:30 to 5:30, then it was tea. And then sometimes we would be detailed for guard, which was a farce more than anything else, just to keep us awake. But if we weren't on guard, we just went in to the barrack room and lay down on our biscuits on the floor and just fell asleep till 6 o'clock next morning.
Lay down on your biscuits?
Yes.
What do you mean?
Well, we hadn't any beds. We had three, what you might call, cushions stuffed with straw. And these were called biscuits.
I see.
And you put these down on the floor, and then you had a blanket. You'd had a blanket and a ground sheet issued to you. So you just got down to it on that.
Were those kind of activities the pattern all the time, or were there any varieties?
Oh, no variety. That was the general pattern of things right throughout the fortnight I was there. Of course, I don't know what happened afterwards.
Now, during this 2 weeks at Farnborough, when you were going through basic training, did you get any particular kind of impression that you were in the Flying Corps?
Not beyond the fact that we had Royal Flying Corps on our shoulders, because there were guardsmen drilling us, and we didn't see any mechanical staff, any of the technical staff of the Air Force of Flying Corps at all. So it was just the guards hammering at us, and we felt like that. And beyond the fact that we had the different uniform, we wouldn't have known we were in anything at all, except the guards.
What stands out most in your mind about this 2 week period at Farnborough?
Well, the rates of pay, first of all, was that the ordinary Tommy in those days got a shilling a day, whereas we got 2 shillings a day as a second class air mechanic. But on joining up, you could get as much as 6 shillings a day. It all depends on the recruiting sergeant, what he offered you. And I was lucky enough to get 4 shillings a day.
How did that work exactly? Could you explain to me the way the offer was made?
Well, they just said, when you joined up, your rate of pay is so much, 4 shillings a day. They had the margins down there. And they just said whatever came into their head.
they presumably had a scale and they placed the individual where they thought was most the most appropriate point on that scale. Is that the way?
I don't think they even used that much intelligence. They just said, well, you'll get 2 bob a day or you'll get 4 bob a day or 6 bob a day.
Does this mean in practice that there could be a great deal of variation between the pay that people holding identical jobs were receiving?
Oh, yes, when you, after a while, you became a first-class mechanic, as distinct from a second. Well, in that case, then you got 4 shillings a day, which was the second class. And then, if you were lucky enough then to become a corporal, there were no lance corporals in those days, or LACs. You went direct from first AM to corporal. Then you got 6 bob a day. But if you'd already been drawing 6 shillings a day, well, you didn't get any more, although you got the rank. And then another thing that comes to mind is that handing our uniform, getting our uniform. As soon as we got our uniform, we were given a piece of string by the quartermaster sergeant and a label, and told to tie our civvies, including underclothing and everything, all up with this string and put a label on it. Then we were marched down to Farnborough post office, where we were ordered to throw them on the ground at the other side of the counter, and they eventually got home that way. I think that's about it.
What was the scale of the RFC establishment at Farnborough at this time? How big was it?
Well, there were about, as far as I can remember, 8 barrack blocks built. They were built in a sort of a temporary style with asbestos and timber. And each block had about 60 or 80 men in it, or perhaps more, when there was a bit of a rush on. But generally speaking, they were up to about, anything from 200 to 400 people there all told. But this varied from day to day, because a batch of 50 or 60 might be sent somewhere one day and then only perhaps 20 or 30 come in, and then another batch sent away the next day, so that it varied some plenty. But the barracks were always seemed to be full when we were on drill.
When you joined the RFC in 1914, the Corps was only a little over 2 years old. Had there, in your experience, been time for it to develop its own sense of regimental identity?
Well, once we got the uniform on, we felt very superior to the ordinary Tommy. And we kept very much to ourselves, because we had a lot of privileges which the ordinary Tommy didn't get. I mean, as far as the people in the town and shops were concerned, for instance, we could always get our hair cut free, whereas the poor old Tommy had to pay his threepence to have his cut outside. I think that's about it.
And at the end of October 1914, you were posted to Brooklands and attached to No. 1 Squadron there. Could you tell me what you can recall about Brooklands as you knew it at that time?
Yes, well, No. 1 Squadron was in the process of reformation, and I was posted there. And when I got to Brooklands, I'd known Brooklands from pictures and things like that, because it was the greatest motor racing track of the time. And as there was a big space in the centre of the track, this was used by civilians for an aerodrome. And Hawker's Sopwith had some hangars there. Martin Handeside had some there. ABC had, the motorcycle people had a workshop there. And there were one or two more. Vickers had a very big place just outside the drum. And there we took over this as the for flying.
These civilian people were still very much in evidence when you were there, were they?
These civilian people were still carrying on, but they weren't doing any flying except test flying, mm-hmm. because they were building a few aircraft in these hangars. And it was used entirely for just testing as far as they were concerned, mostly new types.
Was your impression then that by this time Brooklands had mainly been taken over by the military?
Oh, the Brooklands, except for these particular workshops, had been definitely taken over by the military, but it was previous to that there had been only civilian flying there. And on this Brooklands, there, one corner of it, there happened to be a sewage farm. And this caused quite a lot of trouble with some of the boys, because in the summer, the hot weather, the sun shining down on it, if they hadn't climbed up sufficiently high and then or had an engine failure, well, they just came down in it.
This happen very often?
Oh, it happened often enough to... It didn't happen every day, but it happened often enough to be a well-known fact and to be avoided. And everybody who was flying over was warned to avoid it, because if they didn't, well, then everybody avoided them.
Did you see any interesting aircraft being developed at Brooklands by these civilian aircraft manufacturers there?
Well, there was one aircraft called a Sikorsky, designed by Sikorsky, and it was a huge thing, so big, in fact, that we had to cut trenches in the on the ground to let so that it go into the hangar, low enough to go into the hangar. But this thing, it was supposed to have flown in France for 20 miles, but I never saw it flying. And we had they tried all kinds of engines in it. Of course, it was the civilians who were working on it at the time. It wasn't actually part of our business. But on Sunday, usually, some test pilot or other, Hamill or some of those others, were called down to test it and just keep us awake while we were trying to have a nap. It had run from one end of the aerodrome to the other and then pull up and make several more runs, but couldn't get off the ground. Well, from time to time, they kept changing the engines in it. First, they had a Panhard in it, then had a Sunbeam in it, and Napier, anything that they could, any car engine which had been developed into the aircraft line. But we never saw it get off the ground, and I don't know what happened to it eventually.
Could you describe for me the pattern of your activities at Brooklands from the time you arrived there?
Well, when we got to Brooklands, it appeared to be all chaos there. There were about 200 other chaps there who had been drifted in from other parts of the country. And NCOs and everybody were orders about. The officers didn't seem to be of any permanent status. They just seemed to come and go. And there we had some old Moran biplanes, some old Morris Farman biplanes, and we had a couple of Blériots and a couple of Morans. And everybody used to seem to take these up and whenever they liked, but nobody seemed to be actually in charge of them. The NCO come up and say, "You're a mechanic?" You say, "Yes." You say, "Right, get this machine out," and you'd start it up and get out of the way. Well, you mightn't see the aircraft when it came in. You might be away somewhere else, but that was part of the day. And we had one, there was one particular thing there that there were some people supposed to be learning to fly there, but we had one old Blériot there, which the wings had been clipped off, and very small, with a three-cylinder engine in it, same as the Blériot flew the Channel with. And this we used to call the Penguin, because it would go along the ground, but it wouldn't lift. Well, it wasn't supposed to fly. That's why it was clipped down so closely. The idea was to give the pupils a chance of handling the engine and the controls. Well, this went on all right for a little while, but they found it was absolutely a failure, because when you wanted to turn to the left in flying, you put the stick over to the left and the left rudder. But when you were on the ground, if you want to turn to the left, you put the stick over to the right. that brought the aileron down on the right-hand side, and it acted as a sort of a brake or flap, so that helped you to turn to the right. Well, in the case of the Blériot, there were no ailerons. It simply meant that the end of the wing warped a little, the trailing edge warped a little, so as to give it a bend it down or up, as the case might be, while the other one went in the opposite direction. But after three or four crashes, they found that this penguin was an absolute dud, because we had three or four crashes through people going to turn to the left, and they put the stick over to the right. And of course then that was, they just fatal. So they cut out the old penguin after that.
Could you tell me how well your training as a motor mechanic had equipped you to work on aero engines?
Well, it had fully equipped me, because the engines of the aero engines of those days were simply car engines converted to, for the purpose, such as having an odd thrust race put in here or there, something like that. Except the rotary engines, they were a bit tricky, but then it didn't take as long to get into the handling of them. Once we'd overhauled, pulled one of those to pieces and saw exactly what was happening, well, then it just came second nature to us.
Did you find, in fact, that there were any differences between the sort of skills a motor mechanic had and the sort of skills an aero engine fitter had? Or were they much the same?
Well, they were all the same in those days, you see, because anybody who was working as a fitter with the civilian aircraft